Stand aside, everyone! I take large steps!
1, 2, 1, 2!
We not only fought, but we won, too!
1, 2, 1, 2!
There's none of the enemy left, right?
Right! Left!
Hail Miles Gloriosus! Welcome to Rome. Your bride awaits you.
My bride.
Welcome to Putting It Together. This is the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, the self-described Sondheim expert, and today we're going to be talking about Bring Me My Bride, which may be a little bit problematic in today's climate, but I'm really excited to talk about it. I have some of the best fans of this show. I am so overjoyed that there are so many people out there that seem to enjoy what I am creating. This very episode features somebody who reached out to me via email who I thought was bringing up just really good points, so I invited them to come onto the show to discuss a song in full. And not only that, but Christine Chen also hosts another podcast called Bottomless Broadway, and with the Tony Awards coming up here this weekend, I think it's a good show to binge. It's going through all of the Tony-nominated musicals, so you owe it to yourself to go and take a listen to what they're doing over there. It's a big recommend from me. However, before we get too far, let me tell you that Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. They promote and support Alberta-made podcasts and connect their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. And if you have a few moments, there is currently a listener survey happening for the network. I've left a link to that in the description if you're able to participate. The Alberta Podcast Network is also a sponsor this week, so I'd like to highlight a specific show for you. With the song we're talking about today, I think a well-nuanced discussion about masculinity is needed. Luckily, there's a podcast for that, and it's called Modern Manhood. It's a series of interviews toward understanding the many different views of masculinity, and hosted by the great to pronounce Herman Vijagas. Yep, I nailed that one. You can find it and all the great shows by going to albertapodcastnetwork.com. ATB is also a sponsor this week. Specifically, I want to tell you about ATB's Deposit Yourself Here promotion. However, it's not just an everyday bank promotion, because ATB is more than just a bank. So get this, you won't believe where your everyday banking can take you. Each month, ATB is giving away two prizes of $20,000. Canadian dollars, plus a $5,000 bonus prize. It's how they say thanks to their amazing customers. Yes, that's you. So make sure that you're in this month's draw and learn how to maximize your chances of winning. Visit atb.com/deposit for more details. All right, now it's time for Plodding Along. This is where I describe what's currently happening in the plot. So Pseudolus has hidden Philia on the roof of Senex's house and told her that she has escaped. Lycus is terrified to face the coming captain's wrath. That's Captain Miles Gloriosus, who has purchased Philia as his bride. Pseudolus offers to impersonate Lycus and talk his way out of this mess. But that's when Miles makes his glorious entrance and sings this song. Alright, well, thank you to our sponsors. Take a look at the show notes for information about the music we're referencing and how to get your own book of Sondheim lyrics. Oh, and also, I did something a little bit different in this episode. At the end, after you've heard that final music play, I've actually included a pretty lengthy section, I think it's about 3 to 4 minutes, of me and Christine talking before we really started the episode, talking about our favorite Sondheim shows in general. I just want to know if it's something that you liked. And if that's something you'd like to hear more of, I have kind of an idea that's percolating in my head that might work. So let me know if you liked it. Again, send a tweet or an email or however you want to get in contact with me. I'd love to know your feedback. Let's now listen to a section from the original Broadway cast recording of Bring Me My Bride. On the other side is my conversation with podcaster and software engineer Christine Chen.
my bride, I've come to claim my bride. Come tenderly to crush her against my side. Let haste be made, I cannot be delayed. There are lands to conquer, cities to loot, and peoples to degrade. Look at those
arms, look at that chest. Christine Chen, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Hi, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
You know, we start this kind of the same way every time, but it's probably a good way to do it, which is maybe you can introduce yourself and explain a little bit about what it is that you do.
All right. So like you mentioned, I'm Christine. I actually just graduated from college and I will be moving to New York soon for a job. I don't actually work in theater. I'm in software engineering, but I'm super excited to be able to be near Broadway and see all the shows around there and just, you know, be closer to where that all happens.
That's going to be great. I mean, you don't need to have any type of theater background to be on the show. My background is that I've attended a lot of theater. That's about it. I don't have any other formal training myself. I'm curious then, what brings you to Sondheim specifically? Like, what got you into his music?
So when I was in high school, I would listen to those Pandora radio playlists, I guess. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that I would listen to was the musical theater one. And so I think, I don't remember which song it was. I think it might have been It Takes Two or maybe the prologue from Into the Woods. And I had heard that and I had no clue what Into the Woods was. But this whole fairy tale idea, but kind of twisted, intrigued me. So I looked more into it. And then I actually got into the Into the Woods cast recording from that. I listened to that a lot. And then somewhere along the line, I learned that Sondheim was the, like, quote unquote, smart musical theater composer, but I did like what he was doing with Into the Woods and sort of started exploring that a lot more. And I thought it was really interesting, the kinds of subjects that he chose to do that weren't necessarily traditional musical theater subjects.
Yeah, you know, it's wild. Into the Woods was also my, like, first real big introduction to Sondheim. I think I mentioned this on the podcast before. I was part of something called Theater Club in high school, which meant that we actually went and saw theater productions in the bigger town a couple hours north of us. So we'd get on the little bus and go up there and watch them. And so one of the musicals the one year was Into the Woods. And I knew West Side Story a little bit, but I didn't know a lot about Stephen Sondheim. It was kind of cool to have them teach us a little bit about him before we went and watched the show. Because I had no idea, I thought that the end of Act One was literally the end of the show. And I was like, oh, that's fun. That was a fun show. Some interesting concepts. And it's like, oh, no, there's a whole other second act. And that's when things go like really dark and twisted.
Right.
Like, whoa, what's going on? So as a teenager, that really, really blew my mind.
Yeah, I think I felt the same way. It was like, oh, look, all these fairy tales. And I think it caught me because I really liked how they were intertwined together. But then once you get to the second act, it's like, oh, there's more to this. There's consequences. And now everything they do, everything's just so interrelated and everything.
Yeah. Now, that's broadened out to other musical theater as well. Like, were you a fan of musical theater before you were even introduced to Sondheim?
Yeah. My first introduction was probably actually Phantom of the Opera, which is, you know, very different, but it just sort of became like I consider myself a musical theater fan. I want to just know more about what other musical theater standards are. I started just kind of trying to listen to different albums or different songs that a lot of people kept mentioning and just seeing whatever shows would be in like my area whenever I could.
I feel a little bit jealous because you mentioned that you were listening to the Pandora radio, and up here in Canada, at least, Pandora was never a thing. Like, it never was brought out here. There's some interesting different laws in Canada about streaming services and stuff like that. So anyways, Pandora was never available for Canadians.
That is kind of sad.
But then Spotify was, which is probably now partly why Spotify is now so ubiquitous around the world and stuff like that. So I would have loved that, though, growing up, just having a dedicated channel that I could go and listen to, which would have been great. How about this show in particular? Like, we're in the very first show that Sondheim ever wrote music and lyrics for, at least that got produced on Broadway. And as with many of my guests that I've talked to here this season, we've been mentioning how interesting it is that it was this show that was his first one, this kind of like slapsticky comedy kind of throwback, where there's not a whole lot of characters necessarily that he's writing for, more like stock characteristics that he's writing for. This is me burying the lead, but I'm curious, like, what you think of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum in general.
So, to be honest, I don't actually have too much of a history with this show. I have not seen it, and I haven't seen the movie either. But
to be honest, you don't really need to see the movie, but that's my personal
opinion.
That's
what I've heard. So, yeah. My first actual interaction with the show was when I was in elementary school. We had this, like, music class where we would just kind of sing selections from, I guess, the American music pantheon.
Right.
And one of them was Comedy Tonight. And I was like, oh, that's kind of a cool song. Like, a lot of cool rhymes and lyrics. And I didn't really know what half the lyrics meant either, like pantaloons and eunuchs and all
Cupidity,
of that.
Cupidity, maybe.
Yeah. And so I was just like, oh, these are cool words. But I think that probably might have been a super early introduction to just how Sondheim likes to play with those words and fit them together. And I didn't realize until way later that that was actually a Sondheim song that he wrote.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So that kind of came full circle.
Yeah. And if you ever want to feel like less on yourself, just remember that he also wrote this song like over a weekend.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Which is pretty incredible. But other than that, I did try to figure out what the plot was, like read the Wikipedia summary, which was, I had to read it a few times just because there were so many characters.
Yeah, it's wild. I can only imagine, because if you just read the plot description, it almost makes absolutely no sense.
Yeah. I do think he helps it out by naming the characters very, like, easy names to understand what their role is, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, heroes, you know, the hero.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. So that did help out, but it took a little bit of time to dig through that.
Well, yeah, this song is interesting. This is actually the song that closes out Act One. And it's this introduction of this character called Miles Gloriosus who comes in because, again, of all the different plot contrivances that are going on, this is the man who wants to come and marry Felia, but now Soothless is pretending that she is dead. So this is the introduction, though, to this character, and they're going to try and pull the wool over his eyes so that he can go away, and Soothless can eventually get his freedom that he's been so craving. But this is a really interesting way to end Act One, which is the introduction of this character, and then the curtains close before Act Two comes up.
Yeah, I thought, because I did see the song list, and Wikipedia, thankfully, breaks it down into Act One and Act Two, because they don't include the songs in their plot summary, so it's kind of hard to tell where some of them happened. But it seems like one of those, kind of like Maureen's entrance in Rent, where you're just waiting, like, the whole show kind of for this other character that maybe has been mentioned by the people who you do see on stage. And then they finally show up with this, like, big song, and then it's kind of like, and curtained.
You know, I have to admit something here too. This is the type of song that I really love a lot, which is like the song that a character sings in a musical, like, and they have no other songs at all in the entire show, but it's just their chance, like, show off, like, their voice or their comedic timing or whatever it happens to be. And it's like, honestly, to me, this is very similar to like Gaston in Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah,
right?
I thought of that too. How they're, like, the crowd is just praising how big his arms and thighs and stuff are.
So Miles, the first Gaston, that is basically what we're trying to say here today. But yeah, it's like that baritone voice, and he's like a big braggart, and he's like, just look how great and stuff I am. So those are the songs that I, for whatever reason, I tend to like. It's just a crowd pleaser in and of itself.
Oh, one of the things I did find interesting was when I first saw the title, Bring Me My Bride, I thought it would be a lot more aggressive of a song, or more like slightly more swagger maybe, but it's very operatic in its nature.
Right.
Like, he does have this very low voice, he's singing like long sustained phrases, so I'm not sure if that plays as like funnier on stage with whatever staging they might have, or if that's more of the style of what they wanted this kind of traditional Roman show to be.
You know, that's a good point. I actually think you're probably right. I think this is probably very intentional on, like, the writers and probably even Sondheim's part to at least put into the audience's minds of this, you know, swashbuckling tenor of an opera singer or something like that coming in there, just because that's what those types of shows are all about, them coming out and, you know, showing them how good they are or how much of a lover they are, that whole thing. So I think that probably is very intentional, that this is a break from the rest of the music in many ways, where this does sound way more operatic than anything else that you're going to hear in this show.
Yeah.
Just going back to one other thing you said before we delve into the lyrics here, this is a plea for Wikipedia editors to please include the song titles where they appear when you do write the write-up, because it makes me doing this show way easier so that I know exactly some of the plot points that have happened in between songs. But
I mean, the best is when they just have like a 2-sentence summary and... That's it for the plot.
Yeah, this is what happens. Oh, great. Thanks. To be honest with you, I don't know how much you know of Sondheim's like really lesser known works, but the next show we'll be discussing is something called Anyone Can Whistle. Mm-hmm. And it is similarly, if I just sat here and told you the plot description of that show, you would think I'd be like a crazy person. It is really bizarre.
I think that's what I've heard about it. I don't know too much about it, but I've heard it's very strange show, but I think it has good music.
There's a few standouts for sure, but it's a really weird show, which is probably why it only lasted 9 days before it had to close down, sort of thing. It's also I have to retract this statement. It's the only musical I know of that's in three acts instead of two.
Oh. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I know plays that are in three acts, but I've never seen another musical be in three acts. But Anyone Can Whistle is.
Huh, that's interesting.
So, as I said, this is the character Miles Gloriosus, which is just fun to say. I like to give credit where it's due, so I want to just mention the three different actors who've portrayed this role, at least in the shows that we're going to be focusing on here this season. So in the original Broadway cast, this is sung by Ronald Holgate. In the film version, it's Leon Green. And in the 1996 revival, it's by Chris Groendahl. So those are the three people who have portrayed this character before. And I will say, too, because I'm reading these lyrics from Finishing the Hat, the book, what's too bad is that Sondheim does not include some of the preamble that comes up before he actually starts into the song itself. Because which version or versions were you able to listen to?
I was mostly listening to the original Broadway cast.
Yeah. Okay. So the original Broadway cast does this, which is they do some play on words at the very beginning. Because it's like 1, 2,
right.
1, 2, right? So like he's playing on like the numbers 1 and 2, and then it's like we won, WON 2 TOO. So he's playing with that language. And then I love this moment that happens where they're going like left, right. That's what the soldiers behind him are saying. And then he's like, none of our foes are left, right? And they go right, left. And then they kind of trip up and everything because he's flipped them off their rhythm. So again, this works way better visually when it's on stage. But I like those moments of comedy. I should have asked you just right up front. Was anything about this song funny to you?
I think that part was probably the funniest.
Mm-hmm.
Especially you can hear in the Broadway recording after the right, left, right, right. You can hear kind of either them falling over or running into something because they just got off step.
Right, right.
And I think that was the funniest part. A lot of this song I thought was either clever or had a lot of interesting sort of like irony, but not necessarily as funny.
This is like another recurring theme. And Sondheim would agree with you, by the way, because he writes about how a lot of these songs are not things that the audience ever laughs at. They laugh at some of the action that's going on in the show. But by and large, except for a few exceptions, nobody laughs during any of the songs because they're clever. They're interesting lyrics. They're witty. But there's nothing that's like, oh, that's I'm laughing because of what you just wrote or said.
Right. And I think Sondheim, as far as that goes, might have almost been too smart for his own good. Like he seems to really want to write these clever lyrics, but what's clever isn't always necessarily funny. And I think that if he had written maybe almost like intentionally poor lyrics, it would be a funnier song in itself.
No, I definitely agree with that. And it's interesting because later on in his career, as he goes through, like, he can write some wickedly funny songs that are really, really good. But I think that this is like young man, like, I don't think he's even in his 30s yet when this show came out. So like, we're still talking like a pretty young guy who is probably like still has a bit of a chip on his shoulder and wants to go for the witty instead of necessarily trying to make people laugh.
Yeah, he has something to prove.
So, Milei starts in his deep baritone. My bride, I've come to claim my bride. Come tenderly to crush her against my side. Let haste be made, I cannot be delayed. There are lands to conquer, cities to loot, and people to degrade.
My bride, I've come to claim my bride. Come tenderly to crush her against my side. Let haste be made, I cannot be delayed. There are lands to conquer, cities to loot, and peoples to degrade.
That's our introduction to this character, this like brutish guy that all the other characters have been somewhat scared of. If you see any of their dialogue or watched the show before, like they know of this person. His reputation precedes him, as they might say. But anything that jumps out at you here in this first little bit?
So I think the first line when he's like, my bride, because he says it first before he starts singing it.
Yeah.
And this might be sort of like a lost in translation thing just from knowing the cast recording, but it seems like he's almost forgetting what he's there for. He's like, my bride. Mm. Oh, wait. Yeah, that's right. I'm here for my bride. And so, and in that whole stanza, he doesn't seem to care as much as you'd think about like, oh, I'm here for a bride, but also, wait, I need to get going. Like, can we hurry it up?
Yeah, that's exactly what jumps out at me, too. Like, this is like, okay, like, let's get this over with. Like, I don't want to take too much time with this. Like, I have to go back to the whole war machine that's behind me.
Yeah, and it's less about the, like, claiming a bride and that you would expect from either that time period or, like, a returning soldier.
I think the other line that really stands out to me here as well is the come tenderly to crush her against my side. So there's two different things there. It's like, there's this tender embrace, but I'm going to crush her at the same time.
Right. He's like a civilized brute, almost.
The soldiers continue on here saying, look at those arms, look at that chest, look at them. And then Milei says, not to mention the rest, even I am impressed. And then he kind of goes on again, my bride, come bring to me my bride. My lust for her no longer can be denied. Convey the news, I have no time to lose. There are towns to plunder, temples to burn, and women to abuse.
Look at those arms, look at that chest, look at them.
Not to mention the rest. My bride, come bring to me my bride. My lust for her no longer can be denied. Convey the news, I have no time to lose. There are towns to plunder, temples to burn, and women to abuse.
So kind of a continuation of what's going on here. What's interesting, again, to kind of continue on with that same point, is I just need this woman to be here to get on with my life. But there's, obviously no love that he's really seeking here in this case, especially when there's that line that continually stands out to me in a modern sense, which is like, and women to abuse. Like, this is not this is not a nice guy, let's just put it that
way. But it's interesting because he doesn't include his bride in that sort of characterization of woman. He's talking about like, oh, I'm going to go off to some other town and abuse their woman. But again, in this stanza, his bride itself is actually more of an afterthought. Though he does mention like lusting after his bride, it just seems like, especially in the way that it's delivered on this recording, it seems like that's what's expected of him. And he's just like, I just want to be able to go on and do my thing elsewhere.
I think that's a really smart point, though. You're right. Like, it's not the bride he wants to abuse. It's the other women. It's like that whole concept of like, oh, if it's another group of people, if it's another like group, then it's okay. But I wouldn't do that to mine. But it's okay if I do it to others.
Yeah.
Type of thing. Which I guess, again, as we find out later, as a person or as a character who is constantly at war and trying to ransack different towns and ethnic groups, that kind of makes sense.
Right.
So the soldier's also saying, look at that foot, look at that heel, mark the magnificent muscles of steel. And then Mile says, I am my ideal. So very full of himself.
Yeah.
I, Miles Gloriosus, I, slaughterer of thousands, I, oppressor of the meek, subduer of the weak, degrader of the Greek, destroyer of the Turk, must hurry back to work.
Look at that foot, look at that heel, mark the magnificent muscles of steel.
I am my ideal. I, Miles Gloriosus, I, slaughterer of thousands, I, oppressor of the meek, subduer of the weak, degrader of the Greek, destroyer of the Turk, must hurry back to work.
a few things I just want to call out there is that for the first three lines of this, or actually first four lines of this stanza, it's all I am, I Miles, I slaughter, I oppressor, right? And then it kind of flips around, which then puts in like what he's doing. So it's like, then it goes into subduer, degrader, destroyer, so that he can rhyme those last few ones.
Right.
But yeah, this is, for me personally, is actually my favorite lyrically of the whole piece here. For whatever reason, I love how he rhymes weak, meek, and Greek altogether.
Right. It's like that thing where it's one more rhyme than you're expecting, because normally
Yes. You
rhyme two things and then there's that extra third one. But I think it works because Greek and Turk are both sort of two regions, so it almost acts as like a transition between those two lines, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think this is a really almost funny line two, because when he's like, I must hurry back to work,
Right. Normally
if you think of people saying that, it's like a businessman in a suit with a briefcase or something, like, oh, I need to get back to work. But he's like, right. No, I need to go back to like slaughtering thousands and oppressing the meek and all
right. Yeah, exactly. Like, this is the entire embodiment of like the alpha male that we're seeing here in musicalized form.
I think also the whole, when he it's like, I'm my ideal. And then earlier also when he was like, even I am impressed.
Yeah.
Like, that is also a little bit funny with, he's just like, oh, look at me. Like, look at this guy. He's so great. Oh, wait, that guy's me.
Right. Yeah. It's like, I'm sure this has happened in Disney films as well, which is like the evil person like looking into the mirror, right? Like, oh, look at this. Like, I am as evil as I think I am.
Yeah. Yeah, which also calls back to like Gaston again.
Okay, I guess so. Yeah, exactly. Looking into the beer stein and stuff like that.
Right.
Miles continues on, I, Miles Gloriosus, and the soldiers say, a man among men. And then Miles goes, I, paragon of virtues. And the soldiers go, with sword and with pen. And then Miles continues on, I, in war the most admired, in wit the most inspired, in love the most desired, in dress the best displayed, I am a parade.
Most inspired, in love the most desired, in dress the best displayed, I am a parade.
I just want to call it that very last line that he sings. It's always stood out to me when I first heard this song, like, I am a parade. It's like such a weird thing to say, I think. And such like a braggy thing, I guess, like, I am as important as an entire parade. But Sondheim writes later on that is the only line that is actually lifted from the source material, the old plays by Plautus, which was like a few of them that have actually survived. That is an actual line that he took from one of the plays, but it's the only line that he used in any of the songs in this show.
That's really funny. Because when I first heard that line, I was like, maybe he just doesn't know how to use that term correctly, or
right,
I don't know, like, if it was also just like, oh, maybe he's less educated, he's just thinking of like the big things that he's seen that he's been impressed by.
Yeah, it's still, even if it is lifted from the source material, it's a really weird thing to say.
Yeah.
like if someone told me that in real life, it's like, I am a parade, I'm like, what are you talking about?
Right. One of the other things I do want to sort of go over is when the soldiers say with sword and with pen.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's mentioned how he's like slaughtered thousands and he's obviously a soldier. But then the pen part is like, oh, does he also write poetry or something like that? And he does mention like in wit the most inspired, but that's also himself talking about it. So
yeah, for me, how I've always interpreted this is kind of like what you're saying here is that up until this point, like he is this like, I am bragging about how great I am. And now this is almost turning into like, wait a second, are you just saying this so that you feel good about yourself?
Yeah.
At this point, it's like, you're not just bragging. Now you're like, you're saying you're like the best wit and that you write things now. Like, I don't think you do.
Right. It's kind of just snowballing into, rather than just being the best soldier, he's also the best at like everything that anyone ever does.
Right. He's like those people who, anytime someone tells a story, has to tell like an even better story.
Oh, yeah.
They have to like one up anyone who's like in the conversation. And in this one, he's just literally talking to himself and he's trying to one up himself throughout the entire thing.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Because every stanza, he's basically just trying to like make himself seem even bigger and even more impressive.
So the next part is also something that I think is pretty funny. But so the soldiers say, look at those eyes, cunning and keen. Look at the size of those thighs, like a mighty machine. And then Sudlis goes, those are the mightiest thighs that I ever have seen. I mean, in fact, I actually kind of screwed that up because it's actually even written into here that he's supposed to technically lisp that lyric. So those are the mightiest thighs that I ever have seen, like not seen with an S. He's supposed to do that TH there. I know you've only listened to the original Broadway cast. I actually don't think Zeroma still hits this line very well for it to be very funny.
Okay.
Nathan Lane actually nails this line.
Uh-huh.
And I think it's like super funny when he says it. But what's your take on that?
So I thought it was because part of it is Pseudolus is, you know, trying to pull this scam basically
yes.
off. And so he's like nervous. He was not expecting Miles Gloriosus to to look as, you know, like maybe impressive as he
right.
does. And so he kind of like stutters or like sort of mispronounces his words because he's just like so taken aback was what I assumed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think he is just completely like surprised at, at this man that's kind of standing in front of him
yeah.
here.
Also, maybe a little scared because he's like, oh, no, if this man gets mad at me, like he's going to come after me.
Right. And like the other subtext that's going on here, too, is that, like, gosh, I'm trying to recall this from memory. I believe this is still the part where Sudlis is pretending to be Senex as well. So
right. okay.
This is, I think, also him realizing, oh, I kind of broke character there. I'm supposed
yeah.
to be like, I'm supposed to like be reverent of this person coming here. And I just blurted out that he has mighty thighs, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So the song kind of rounds out here because Miles goes on, my bride, and for my lucky bride, the fabled arms of Miles are open wide. Make haste, I have no time to waste. There are shrines I should be sacking, ribs I should be cracking, eyes to gouge and booty to divide. And then he does his like really big sustained note, bring me my bride.
Yeah.
And that's, yeah, how how Act One ends, basically.
My bride, inform my lucky bride, the fabled arms of Miles are open wide. Make haste, I have no time to waste. There are shrines I should be sacking, ribs I should be cracking, eyes to gouge and booty to divide.
And he does keep doing that thing where he escalates whatever he's saying with
yeah.
the shrine sacking, ribs crack. He gets a little more visual and graphic with it. He's like, all right, what else do I have left that I haven't already said to
yes.
make myself seem more manly?
Let me look up this list here that I made for myself. What have I not said yet? Oh, right. Yes. Ribs are cracking.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about it, like kind of what we started off this conversation with, is that because this is sung in a much more operatic style, it is definitely leaving us on quite literally a high note of of what's been going on. And as it's staged and stuff like that, this is a very impressive character that has just walked on stage, and we're going to learn more about them in Act Two. But I think that overall the song works the way that's intended. It's here to introduce us to this character, to be awed by him, to understand his character fairly quickly and what his motivations are.
Yeah.
And so I think it hits all of those notes pretty well.
Yeah, definitely. You know, like right away by... especially even with the soldiers coming in at the beginning, how they're preceding him and sort of giving him an entourage, he already is a man of a certain stature.
That's right. So overall, I guess, how do you rate this song? Is it, I guess the other question I have is, have you listened to much more of the rest of the soundtrack at all?
Yeah, so I listened to the whole thing a few times. And I do think this is one of the better songs score-wise. Like, the actual score and melody of it is a little bit more of, has a little bit more of that richness. And I think it is one of the better sung ones of the original Broadway recording. And I know you've mentioned on earlier episodes that, in general, that recording does not have the best singers, but...
yes.
I think Ronald Holgate does a really great job with this. One of the things when you mentioned like it going on, out on a high note, and I don't remember where I heard this from, but it was either like Broadway Divas or maybe an opera, was that like if you had like an opera solo or something like that, you would always want to end on like a high note so that people sort of remember that's the last impression of you in someone's mind, in the audience's mind.
Right.
So that people remember, like, oh, yeah, that was really impressive. I want to see them again or something like that.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, so there is, like, that psychological edge that they're probably playing with here as well.
Mm-hmm. And it would just be, like, the character to sort of know that and be like, let me do whatever I can to just make myself more impressive.
Yeah. Actually, and even, I actually don't know if this is how it's staged normally, but the one time I've actually seen this on stage, how... they did this act break was literally he comes out, you know, sings this song, and Sudeilis is like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And he like looks at the audience and he mugs a bit, and I forget what the actual line is, but he'll say something to the audience, and then everyone freezes, and then the curtain came down, and then when it came back up after you have done your act break, they're literally all still frozen in the exact same spot, and they just resume the action from where they left off. Which is an interesting way to do this. So when you come back, it's literally just picking up from where you left off from.
That's actually kind of cool. Do you happen to know if that was like a tradition from like Plautus's era? If that
I don't know. In fact, a classical scholar is going to have to write in and let me know if I'm right on this. I actually don't think intermissions were a thing, for the Greek and Roman tragedies or comedies. Or if they were, I just don't recall them. I remember studying a few of them when I was taking my English degree in the university, but that was more of a later theatrical thing have actually intermissions.
So I wonder if maybe that's Sondheim's way of subverting that, or, I mean, I guess it wasn't just Sondheim, but just like, let's pretend this intermission never happened, but since we are writing for modern audiences, they expect an intermission with this long of a show.
Right.
To kind of bridge that gap.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if that was the thinking behind why they did that.
One of the other things, so Melis does mean soldier in Latin, I guess.
Yes.
And so basically his name translates to glorious soldier, which in my opinion is almost like just shy of an oxymoron, because normally a soldier means like you're one of the pack, you're like part of a contingent. You're not really supposed to stand out as a soldier unless you have a ranking, which he, from what we know, doesn't. And so it could maybe be like a name he's bestowed upon himself, or just to give himself a little more recognition or something like that. But in reality, he's not really this big leader off to war. He's just like another one of the guys.
I like that idea that he just gave himself his own name.
Yeah.
To make himself like feel even more important, sort of thing. And that's actually the cool thing here. Even though like some of the character names are coming from Plautus, a lot of them are just using Latin to literally tell us who they are, because Philia just means young woman,
right?
Right. And what else? Senex means old man, which is exactly what he is. So
yeah.
So it's an interesting way to use all of those names and stuff. I hate saying this to kind of go back to something you said before, because I know it's my own personal opinion, but I do constantly say that I don't think that the original Broadway cast has the best singers on it. This is the exception. I think Miley's, like you said, Ronald Holgate does a really great job on this one. In fact, all three of the people who sing this actually do a pretty good job from the three versions that I've listened to. That being said, I think that with the recording technology that was available at the time, I just don't think they're able to grab a lot of the appeal for a lot of these actors and stuff, which is too bad, because I'm sure it was, from all intents and purposes and from what audiences and reviewers say, this is a really great show.
Mm-hmm. From back then. It was then. Interesting because Holgate actually started out in opera, so he is trained, I guess, in that genre. So I wonder if they like cast him on purpose because of that, or if he just had like fit that bill at an audition or something like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. That would be interesting to find out. Let me just do a quick little click here. What else has he done? Oh, he was also in the original production of 1776.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, how about this? I know that you've not seen a production of this. Having now listened to the score and talking about this song, is it something that you would try and see if it were put on that close to you?
I definitely think so. Also knowing like how long it ran originally and how funny it should be, even if the score is not particularly funny, I think it is one of the shows that you have to see to be able to appreciate it. And the cast recording maybe doesn't do it justice. And maybe, I think you might have also mentioned this before in other episodes, but the songs sometimes do either slow down the action or sort of run parallel to the humor, not exactly working right with the humor.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple things going on. I do think, again, going with what Sondheim himself even writes, I do agree that for the most part, I think the songs and the text are a little bit at odds with each other, just with the type of humor that they're trying to use, and it does stop the action to go and sing a song. That being said, for the most part, a lot of these songs do need to actually be seen in order to be funny,
right?
I think, because of the situation that they happen to find themselves in, or because of the action that's happening at the same time. Not that it's my favorite song by any stretch of the imagination, but Everybody Ought to Have a Maid, I don't think really works at all just listening to it. But it does make sense if you actually watch what's going on at the same time. Same thing with Lovely. At least the reprise is super funny just because of the situation that Cilla Snow finds himself in.
Yeah, I think just listening to Everybody Has Made or Everybody Ought to Have a Maid, I think I could tell it was supposed to be funny, especially because it has like three endings. Like it ends and starts back up. And you can tell there's definitely something happening there to sort of cause that. But just listening to it, it's still pretty smart, but it's not like laugh out loud funny.
Right. Yeah. You need to see the kind of the visual gags that are going on, and the fact that they keep adding on an extra person every time you think the song is about to end, and they kind of continue it back up again, sort of thing. But yeah. Well, Christine, thank you so much for joining me here today. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Good luck with your move to New York. Hopefully you found a good place to actually call home for at least the next little while.
Yeah, that's hopefully, I did find a place which I really liked, and hopefully I'll continue to like it once I'm actually living there.
Yes. I don't know if you do or not, and don't feel like you are compelled to share, but if people did want to see what you're up to online, is there a way for them to do that?
Yeah, so I have sort of two different things going on. I also run a podcast with one of my friends, and we talk about the Tony eligible musicals of each season. We actually just released an episode on Tootsie. It's called Bottomless Broadway. And so if you can find us on Twitter at Bottomless B-Way, or just in any like podcast site, Bottomless Broadway. So if you want to hear more about like those musicals, the more recent ones, can take a listen to that. I also, for my like personal Twitter, I'm sort of in the process of trying to start a blog. With the whole moving thing, I haven't really gotten around to writing too much, but it's called Across the Arch, and that's also the Twitter handle. If you want to follow me, I use that as my personal Twitter as well. So I'll just, you know, post whatever or I'm thinking or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
I'm excited to check those out because that sounds totally up my alley.
Yeah.
For me. And I'm trying to do very quick math here and to see. The Tony Awards will either be, I can't do math that quickly in my head. The Tony Awards will have either been last week or next week when this episode is released. So I'm hoping that it hasn't actually come out yet and people can actually go to your podcast and listen to some of those episodes.
Right.
But before we do it, what do you think the likelihood? What do you think is going to take away Best Musical this year?
Oh, I think Hadestown is pretty much a lock for it. I haven't seen it yet.
No, but just going by buzz that I've heard online, that's what everyone is talking about.
Yeah, and my friend Cindy, who I do the podcast with, we actually did a podcast on Hadestown last week. And so she loved it, had like only good things to say about it. Made me really jealous, actually, because I haven't seen it and it's already super hard to get tickets for. So, yeah, I think that's a big contender. I did really like Tootsie, though, because I saw that while I was in New York.
Yeah, I've heard good things about that one, too.
So it should be a pretty fun Tony Award ceremony, too, with all the performances and all of that.
I always look forward to it. It's like, I always tell people, I watch the Oscars every year too. And I'm kind of an Academy Awards apologist in many ways because it's like, I know that there's some things wrong with it. That it's too long, but I still like watching it every year. But the Tony Awards is like the ones like, if you just don't think you like award shows, watch the Tonys because everyone is so happy to have won an award and the speeches are way better and the performances are really good. So I'm always
down. Exactly.
It's always a great time.
And the hosts always do something fun. It's James Corden this year, which actually, funnily enough, James Corden was supposed to lead a revival of Borum. He was supposed
to be
Cedalus, but then he got his late night talk show, so that never ended up happening.
Well, he could have maybe become a 2-time Tony winner because every single person who's played Cedalus has won a Tony Award for that role. So we could have seen if it would have continued on. Well, Christine, again, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this.
So much fun! Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network and to ATB this week. Next time, we're going to be talking about that dirty old man. No, not the leader of the country, the song. If you have additional feedback, comments, questions, or a great guest idea, please send those to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Also, a big thank you to the always great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. For now, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
I don't know if you've ever mentioned, but what's your favorite Sondheim musical, actually?
Oh, okay. So this kind of varies sometimes. I will say that I have just this really, I don't even know what the right term is, but like my love started with Into the Woods. So I usually go back to that show specifically, mostly because I think it is like the best example of simple lyrics absolutely having really deep meanings, which is what Sondheim is kind of known for.
Yeah.
As I've gotten older, I will say that Company starts to mean a lot more to me because I actually identify with a lot of the stuff that's going on in that show. And then, of course, Sweeney Todd is like the big answer.
Right.
So yeah. I would say those three are kind of like the big heavyweights for me. But then I can always have conversations about like lesser loved ones because I'm a big fan of Passion as well, which no one really ever talks about.
Yeah.
How about you?
So when I was sort of preparing for this, I realized I think I've only ever actually seen two Sondheim musicals live, which are Into the Woods and Merrily.
Okay.
And so I think in general, Into the Woods would be my favorite. It's also the first thing that sort of brought me to Sondheim, where my history with Sondheim starts. I have grown to be a lot bigger fan of Merrily since I've seen it. I kind of went into it blind, had no clue what the history behind that was. And I think the music is just spectacular. And
The music's
what
great,
they were trying
man.
To do was really like, I understand what they were trying to do, and I really like that idea. I think just, you know, it's the way they couldn't quite pull it off, and so it sort of fascinates me too.
It's a fascinating failure in many ways. It's was it a full-on production, or was it like the little cabaret setting one where they just like are singing the songs?
It was a full production. Okay. Like the off or the most recent revival.
Yeah,
it was like
right.
that same track list.
Okay. Yeah. Because that's also another one where they've kind of changed things.
Yeah.
Occasionally. I actually think Merrily would work. It's one of the few that I think would work better as a film, because then you can have old and young. You can cast an old person, young person, have that kind of crossover where it's a little bit harder to do, I think, in a play. But yeah, Sondheim talks about that a lot. It's like, it's a great idea. The music is great. The execution doesn't work.
Yeah. They're still trying to fix it. So
yeah, they're still trying
maybe
to
one day.
Out.